Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents British Cinema, A Very Short Introduction, by Charles Barr. Narrated by Kevin E. Green. Publisher's Note. In this audio edition, you will hear references to figures present in the print and e-book formats of the book. Chapter 1. Britain and Cinema. This is a very short introduction to British cinema, not to British films. The distinction is not pedantic. The word cinema demotes more than just an accumulation of films. Cinema is also, variously, a technology, a building, an industry, and an institution through which films are received and circulated. The aim here is not simply to discuss a range of British productions, but to explore what is distinctive about the way cinema, in all its aspects, has developed in Britain. Late in the 19th century, there evolved the mechanical novelty of moving pictures. The cinematograph, sometimes kinematograph, was the device that recorded movement and could project the result. Cinematograph shows were presented in a variety of locations, such as fairground tents, or as one element in a music hall programme. From the start, British showmen were active in developing and exploiting the new cinema technology. Early in the new century came the first of the specialised buildings devoted to showing cinematograph films regularly, converted from previous uses, or increasingly purpose-built. Cinemas. And there grew up an industry, the cinema, to supply and to serve this growing market. In many countries, this included a busy production sector, turning out a stream of films for their own cinema audiences, and if possible, exporting them as well. In other countries, the production sector hardly existed, but cinema could still flourish, as a business, based on running chains of cinema buildings and supplying them with films from elsewhere, and as part of the culture, based on going to the cinema and on reading and writing about films. Ireland, for instance, developed a flourishing film culture of this kind long before it had its own studios or produced more than the occasional Irish film. Britain has always had its own production sector, but ever since cinema developed from a novel technology into an industry, its screens have been dominated by American films. The exhibition side of cinema has been primarily a structure for promoting Hollywood product, and continues to be so. Just look at the programme of any British multiplex. Britain's own films provide the main focus of this book, but they need, always, to be located within this wider picture of cinema and cinema growing in Britain. It is above all the continuing struggle for self-definition, self-assertion, against the dominance of Hollywood that gives British films their distinctive identity, or more accurately, identities, given the diversity at all times of the product. Some have argued that the struggle has been hardly worth it. Here are three verdicts from authoritative voices in, respectively, Britain, France and America. The British cinema is as dead as before. Perhaps it was never alive. V.F. Perkins, 1962. Isn't there a certain incompatibility between the terms cinema and Britain? François Truffaut, 1966. English films have always been a sad joke. Pauline Kael, 1968. It may seem pointless to revisit diatribes like these half a century later, but they made a powerful impact at the time and continued for decades to cast a shadow. Perkins was writing in the first issue of the most influential film magazine of the time in Britain, Movie. Truffaut's question was posed to Alfred Hitchcock in a classic interview book that has never gone out of print. Coming from a celebrated young cine-literate representative of the French New Wave, his scepticism carried weight. Pauline Kael was America's most celebrated film critic, collecting all her reviews in books which sold well in Britain, as in America, and which likewise still circulate. Of course, there were striking new films being made in Britain, but they were seen as minor compared with the best from Hollywood and Europe. Many others reinforced this view. For instance, the Francophile British critic Peter Graham, with his incisive 1963 booklet, The Abortive Renaissance, Why Are Good British Films So Bad? I must insert here at the start a form of personal signature. Any short survey like this of a big topic has to be selective, the selection being driven by the place and time that the surveyor is coming from. My own cinematic roots are in the Britain of this 1960s decade, a time of major change in two connected ways. First, it saw the definitive takeover by television as the dominant mass medium, and thus a shift in the status of cinemas. Second, it was the formative decade for film study, a fresh term for a newly intense engagement with cinema by critics, and, not long after, in academia. The seeding of what has from nowhere become as common a subject of study in higher education as literature or geography. In the early 1960s, this was only just starting. Few books on cinema yet existed. Access to old films was very limited. Those dismissive accounts of British cinema, past and present, had a collective force that no polemics in today's much more crowded field could hope to match. Between them, they helped to establish, as an orthodoxy within the new field of study, a negative line on British cinema. My own tentative early writings were all on American or French films. Over the years this would change, not by a sudden conversion, but British cinema history became, gradually, a rival interest, and then a major one. For this to happen, as it did for many others, two things were needed. An understanding of how and why it had become so fashionable to be so scathing, and the chance to see plenty of old British films. Seeing them was not easy. How did one find them? The range of British and other films available to us now, and the ease of access to them, would for a long time have been unimaginable. The story of change in the ways we access films is itself a central part of the history of cinema. And it is precisely this process of change that has enabled us, progressively, to gain a fuller, clearer view of the history of Britain's own film production, thus rendering those imperious dismissals of the 1960s ever harder to sustain. But they are themselves, in turn, an important strand in the history. Seeing old films. For a long time, films could be seen only in cinemas, and you had to catch them quickly. A few popular items, such as Chaplin's silent comedies, did get re-shown in the early years, but they were rare exceptions. Already in 1918, the leading British screenwriter of the time, Elliot Stannard, was protesting against this ephemerality. "We are seeking to find some solution whereby successful films may be saved from premature and needless oblivion." Those words come from the fourth in a series of five articles by Stannard, The Art of Kinematography, in the weekly trade paper Kinematograph and Lantern Weekly. The reference to the Magic Lantern Show, not dropped from the title until the following year, is a reminder of the sheer novelty, still, of the medium of cinema. Just as the word art is eloquent of its and Stannard's aspirations. None of his own earliest films were revived, and many remained lost, but the Imperial War Museum in London, founded in March 1917, was already rescuing war footage from oblivion, laying the foundations of a pioneer film archive. Britain was thus a leader in recognising the cultural and historical significance of the young medium. A few years later, Stannard teamed up with a young British director and scripted, solo or in partnership, the first nine of his films, made between 1925 and 1929. Alfred Hitchcock, figure one. All but one of the nine survive and are now accessible in high-quality restored prints. But this is recent, dating from the London Olympics year of 2012, when the British Film Institute, BFI, celebrated the life and work of Hitchcock as their contribution to the tie-in Cultural Olympics programme. Until then, all but one of the surviving eight, The Lodger, 1927, remained unrestored and little seen. They were lying in the archive for decades, but it took years for the films to become at all widely known, in Britain or abroad. This is symptomatic of the slow process of opening up the full and varied terrain of British film history. The figure of Hitchcock will inevitably be a recurring reference point in tracking this process. How do we explain the fact that the single most celebrated and most studied of all filmmakers spent his first 40 years and made his first 23 films in his native Britain? For Truffaut and others in the 1960s, the answer was simple. He was a solitary genius, working in an unsympathetic environment, and only fulfilled his promise when he moved to Hollywood in 1939. This became a confident element in the new critical orthodoxy, but the more familiar we become with his work within British cinema, and with the history of that cinema, the less convincing that argument will be. We can trace three stages in the widening of access to past films: repertory cinema, armchair cinema, and desktop cinema. Repertory cinema. The year when Stannard and Hitchcock began work on their first collaboration, The Pleasure Garden, 1925, also saw the launch of the Film Society in London. It helped to establish a separate, modest branch of exhibition running parallel to the main commercial outlets, and this in turn encouraged the foundation of more film libraries and archives, an international phenomenon mainly of the 1930s, with Britain again among the leaders. Such collections allowed a certain access to cinema's past, but a limited one, depending on what was available for screening and on what was chosen. For British film history, this amounted to little. The Lodger was an isolated part of the repertory, joined during the 1930s by Blackmail and some other Hitchcock sound films, and by a number of documentaries, but not much else. The main aim, after all, was to bring in attractive films from abroad. This system of repertory cinema, gradually expanding, remained for decades the dominant means of access to cinema's past. In London in the 1960s, a typical neighbourhood cinema was the Tolmer, off the Euston Road, which ran three double bills per week of old or oldish films, figure two. There was a weekly excitement in checking the listings magazine, What's On, in London, to find out what was showing where, and in planning a schedule. The same applied elsewhere, in university cities especially. This was one of the ways in which people of that generation were able to build up knowledge of past cinema, above all of Hollywood. British films rarely featured in the Tolmer programme, but they could be picked up here and there, for instance at the National Film Theatre, NFT, on the South Bank, established in the 1950s by the BFI, or at the Classic Cinema in Baker Street, part of a small repertory chain which sometimes showed a Hitchcock thriller from the 1930s, or a post-war Ealing comedy. But this kind of commercial repertory cinema was on the way out. The Tolmer closed in 1972, the Baker Street Classic in 1973, the main reason being, of course, the desertion by now of the mass audience to television, which now became the major source for old films, British included. Armchair cinema. A high-profile weekly drama series, launched in 1956 on the Independent Television Network, ITV, was called Armchair Theatre. The BBC's television monopoly had been broken by Act of Parliament in 1954 in response to the new medium's steady growth in geographical coverage and, linked to this, popularity. On both channels, the dominant form of fiction was still the play, transmitted live from the studio, film being used occasionally for inserts of location footage. As video technology developed from the late 1950s onward, plays were increasingly broadcast in pre-recorded form, but the two media would long remain far more separate, formally and in other ways, than they are today. At first, few cinema films had been shown on TV. Up to 1972, broadcasting hours were restricted by law. Moreover, a number of leading British producers had banded together in 1958 to form FIDO, the Film Industry Defence Organisation, to block the sale of their films to the rival medium. But by the time Armchair Theatre ended in 1974, this defence had collapsed, allowing access to a growing number of British films. They could not yet be recorded at home, but had to be seen at their own pace at the time of transmission. Armchair cinema is an apt term. As television expanded and cinema going declined, The BBC and ITV came to constitute a powerful duopoly, parallel, in fact, to the fading duopoly of the Rank Organisation and Associated British Cinemas, ABC, with their nationwide chains of cinema theatres. Later, the TV channel's powers would extend into film production, but already, in their role as exhibitors, they began to offer an alternative British cinema, a space where audiences came together to see cinema films, many of them British. Not new ones, but often still reasonably fresh and attractive, or old and attractive. This was not exactly a communal space, as in cinema theatres, but there was an awareness, even if not articulated, that masses of people were watching the same film at the same time. A film's TV screening could be an event. For the comedian Al Murray, in his 2013 memoir, "To some, the 70s is all about flares and disco, or Mohican haircuts and punk. To me, the 70s is war films on the telly." He even entitles the book "Watching War Films with My Dad." Some of these were American, others British, like The Dam Busters, 1955. A routine to relax nostalgically into after Sunday lunch. It was not just Sunday afternoons. In 1968, Leslie Halliwell had moved from running a repertory cinema in Cambridge to become the buyer of films for the ITV network. His enterprise helped to stimulate competition on the part of the BBC's schedulers. The weekly search through the listings magazines for details of old films that were showing in cinemas began to be echoed now in the weekly routine of checking the TV schedules and noting films to watch. The launch in 1982 of ITV's second channel, Channel 4, gave fuller scope for coherent programming. Early in its life, Halliwell introduced in person a 12-part weekly series, Yesterday's Britain, a selection of British films from the Second World War, features and documentaries, and short propaganda items. Soon after came a successor series, going beyond the war years. These were films that had been unseen for decades, except by archival researchers, or perhaps, a few of them, by specialist film society or film theatre audiences. And the two series were complemented by others on Channel 4 or BBC Two, some with a British focus. The growth in the 1980s of the VHS market and of domestic video recording meant that individuals and libraries could start building collections, which fed into publications and academic courses, on, of course, Hollywood and French cinema, on Ingmar Bergman and Italian neorealism, but also on British films. Desktop cinema. Today we have access to a vastly greater amount via the computer screen as well as the TV screen, but it is harder to make sense of. The four TV channels have expanded to scores of channels, giving a mass of films to choose from every week, with little approach anymore to coherent programming, plus a comparable range of films available to stream online or buy cheaply on DVD. It is a form of cinema now controlled, crucially, by the consumer, not the exhibitor. The range of historic British films now easily available, whether from TV channels or DVD purchase or downloading, is thus amazingly wide. To complement the abundance of films has come an abundance of books on British cinema, everything from the very general to the very specific. This is all welcome, but it creates an embarrassment of riches. Confronted by so much, it can be hard to see the wood for the trees. This book can at least try to sketch the outlines of the wood and some paths that lead through it. In the 1970s, I subscribed for a time to a newsletter for film collectors and bought some cheap short items on 16mm film, an almost obsolete format now, but then the prime one for educational use. Also on offer for upwards of £200 were some complete features, including Hitchcock's The 39 Steps from 1935. The temptation then was resistible, but in the 1980s it became the first film I bought as a commercial VHS tape for £35. Now it can be bought on DVD, in shops or online for under £5, in a variety of versions, with or without extras and audio commentary, or it can be watched for nothing in full on YouTube. All this we take for granted in the new age of desktop cinema. Whatever format you choose for washing the 39 steps, it starts the same way. Richard Hannay, Robert Donat, buys a ticket and joins a crowded theatrical audience, thus re-enacting what every audience member at the time would just have done in order to see the film. The theatre is an East London music hall, not a cinema, but the parallel is clear. Hannay is our surrogate, an everyman onlooker who finds himself thrown into a sudden adventure and comes out happier at the end of it. Both he and the cinema-goer have paid their money in order to be taken out of themselves, to undergo the series of beneficial shocks that Hitchcock always referred to as central to his concept of cinema. Figure 3. An alternative concept for him was that of the fairground roller coaster. No film has constructed a better roller coaster, a more artful succession of shocks, than the 39 Steps. You cannot pause a roller coaster in the middle of the ride. Momentum is all. Hitchcock's 50-year career as a director ended in the mid-1970s, shortly before the rise of domestic video, well before the internet. One reason for his special status within and far beyond British cinema history is the way he crafted his films so precisely for the linear time span of cinema, and for an audience sitting together in a cinema theatre. It cannot be said too often that, in watching films, old ones especially, you have to recapture, at least in imagination, but when possible in reality, that pre-video, pre-desktop experience of cinema as cinema, in order properly to engage with the product and feel its full power. Chapter 2. Varieties of Britishness. If cinema is a fluid term, then so is British. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences was founded in Hollywood in 1927. A British equivalent followed 20 years later, inspired by the high achievement of the country's filmmakers in the war years. The British Film Academy, now the British Academy of Film and Television Arts, BAFTA. The annual BAFTA awards include a category for Best British Film. The winner in 2014 was the spectacular 3D production Gravity. Its nomination caused surprise. What was British about it? The two stars are, like the main funding, American, George Clooney and Sandra Bullock. The writer-director is Mexican, Alfonso Cuarón. And it is set in space and in America, but it was made in a British studio, using British resources and skills, and it accumulated enough points to count technically as British. Protesters argued that in no way was it culturally British, but the nomination was approved, and it won. No one picks up a book on a British cinema expecting to read about films like Gravity. Its award would have been unthinkable to the group of filmmakers who set up the Academy at that time of post-war optimism and energy for British production. Their prime aim was to recognise those who had contributed outstanding creative work towards the advancement of British film. The founding group included directors Carol Reed and David Lean, director-star Laurence Olivier, the director-writer partnership of Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, and producer Michael Balkan from Ealing Studios. Between them, they could look back on recent successes, like Lean's Brief Encounter, 1945, and Great Expectations, 1946, Reed's Odd Man Out, 1947, Olivier's Henry V, 1944, Powell and Pressburger's I Know Where I'm Going, 1945, and A Matter of Life and Death, 1946, and Ealing's Dead of Night, 1945, and forward to films like Oliver Twist, Lean, 1948, Hamlet, Olivier, 1948, The Red Shoes, Powell and Pressburger, 1948, The Third Man, Reed, 1949, and the explosion of Ealing comedy in 1949, Kind Hearts and Coronets, Passport to Pimlico, Whiskey Galore. Those titles belong to British cinema in a way that Gravity does not. It would have made more sense for the 2014 award to go to, say, Philomena, one of the other nominees. It seems not just technically British, but culturally so. Through its director Stephen Frears, its stars Judi Dench and Steve Coogan, its writer Jeff Pope, and its story of the real-life campaign by a British journalist to help a mother track down her long-lost son, forcibly given away by nuns for adoption. It was set and shot partly in the USA, and set, though not shot, partly in the Republic of Ireland. But, of course, films have always crossed national boundaries. Even among those films from the much less travel-happy 1940s, Henry V and Odd Man Out went to Ireland, The Red Shoes to France and The Third Man to Vienna. One major difference, though, is that the 1940s titles were all but one, The Third Man, financed by the dominant British company of the time, the Rank Organisation, whereas Philomena is technically a British-American-French co-production. Companies listed on the credits include BBC Films, the British Film Institute, Weinstein, America, and Pathé and Canal Plus, France. This is typical of how films conceived in Britain are now financed, partly by television companies, in an increasingly globalised age. A main selling point for Philomena, both at home and overseas, was precisely its high-quality Britishness, linked especially to Frears and Dench and their classy track records. It does not, however, belong to the kind of British cinema represented in 1935 by The 39 Steps, or 10 years later by I Know Where I'm Going. That has ceased to exist. Those films were made for viewing by audiences in cinema theatres, part of a purposeful continuity of production to serve primarily those theatres, the two spheres being linked within a vertically integrated structure on the American model. The same companies made or backed the films and showed them across the country in their chains of cinemas, a far more solid network than exists today. We can talk loosely of the cinema of Stephen Frears as of the cinema of Michael Powell, referring simply to a director's output of films. But those directed by Powell were, for the bulk of his career, financed and produced within and for that kind of rooted national cinema. Those of Frears have been funded and shown far more diffusely. For a film like Philomena, the cinema screen of its brief and limited initial release is only one among many platforms. Between them, the careers of Powell, born 1905, and Frears, born 1941, span the whole of the first 90 years of dialogue films. Powell directed his own first film in 1930, and his last in 1972, the year after Frears' feature film debut with Gumshoe. If one has to pick a date to mark the passing of the old British cinema, something coherent and coordinated and of acknowledged national importance, centred on the collective experience of audiences in cinemas, the two men's brief period of overlap at the start of the 1970s is as good as any. We now have a far more fragmented national cinema, or post-cinema, encompassing a variety of mainly one-off films. But even for the films of those earlier decades, the term British can be problematic. British versus English. In a characteristically polemical article in 1957, the critic and filmmaker Lindsay Anderson noted a long-standing confusion. What sort of cinema have we got in Britain? First of all, it is necessary to point out that it is an English cinema, and Southern English at that, metropolitan in attitude and entirely middle class. With rare exceptions, film studios have been clustered in and around London, and their settings and themes and characters have had a corresponding bias. Writing in 1999 about Alfred Hitchcock's pre-Hollywood work, I made a point of using the title English Hitchcock rather than the more usual British Hitchcock, and of quoting Anderson on page one in support of this. Yet a quick check reveals that the word British has so far, in this book, been used more than 50 times, and English just once, in quoting the American critic Pauline Kael. It is hard to avoid this slippage, but it is harder than ever now to use the word British innocently, in the aftermath of two referendum votes. In 2014, 45% of Scots voted in favour of leaving the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and the issue remains a live one. In 2016, Britain voted 52-48 for British exit, or Brexit, from the European Union, leading to the UK's departure after more than 40 years. more accurately, England and Wales did, while there was a clear majority for Remain in both Northern...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?